Good morning, and welcome everyone to Crédito Real's first quarter 2021 earnings conference call. Crédito Real issued its quarterly report on Wednesday, April 28, 2021. If you did not receive a copy via email, please do not hesitate to contact us in Mexico City at +52 55 5228 9753. It is important to note that the presentation and MP3 recordings referred to this call will be available at www.creal.mx. Before we begin the call today, I would like to remind you that the information discussed in today's call may include forward-looking statements on Crédito Real's future, financial performance, and prospects, which are subject to risk and uncertainties. Actual results may differ materially, and the company cautions not to rely unduly on these forward-looking statements. The company undertakes no obligation to publicly update or revise any forward-looking statement. With us this morning from Crédito Real, we have Mr. Ángel Romanos, Executive Chairman, Mr. Carlos Ochoa, CEO, and Ms. Renata Gonzalez, IRO. They will discuss on the more important strategic, financial, and operating aspects of the first quarter 2021. I will now turn the call over to Mr. Romanos.
Thank you, operator. Good morning, everyone. This is a very special call for me as it marks a very important and positive step forward in Crédito Real's decades-long and successful journey. So I would like to begin by thanking you all for the very warm and constructive relationships that we've been able to build over time. Thank you for the trust you've placed in us and in me personally. The steps that we're taking as an organization are intended to deepen that trust. Here's a couple that I want to highlight. In line with international best practices in terms of corporate governance, we've divided the role of chairman and CEO, appointing different individuals in each. As chairman of the board, I can speak for the entire group. When I see, we're very proud to have appointed Carlos Ochoa, whom you all know very well, as the new CEO of the company. There is truly no better individual to lead the company's executive team, and we're all looking forward to the many successes I'm sure he'll bring about in this company. Also, in line with strengthening governance at Crédito Real, the Board of Directors will be taking a more proactive role in defining key strategic items. These strengths, oversight, and accountability, while leaving additional room for the executive team to focus on achieving the ambitious goals we have set in terms of improving our portfolio and deepening our differentiation. Carlos will speak more about this in a few minutes. I will leave all the details to Carlos and Renata, but before I do that, I want to thank you again for your unwavering trust. I remain as inspired by our purpose as I was in day one. We will continue working to support the dreams of unattended people and small companies in the Americas, as we have done over 25 years. Reaching at this report the transcendental milestone of 1 million customers. And I look forward to continuing to discuss our progress over time with you all. Please do stay in touch. Carlos, quite literally, I hand it over to you now.
Thank you, Angel, for your kind words. Good morning, everyone, and many thanks for being with us today. I can only second what Angel has said with regards to how extremely valuable we hold the relationship that this company has built with analysts and investors over the years. We definitely consider this relationship as a substantive asset for Crédito Real. It's also a very special call for me. I am particularly humbled to be here as the new CEO of Crédito Real. I am proud to have spent almost three decades learning from industry leaders like Angel and the incredible team he has built here. Despite the overall macro challenges, I am confident that the strong foundations built under Angel's tenure as CEO Centers on a solid track to successfully share the unattended segments of banking, and over this activity create sustainable value for our stakeholders. His continued leadership as chairman of the board will remain invaluable for the company. Going into my assessment of the reporting period, the first quarter of 2021 marks the one-year anniversary of COVID-19 in the Americas. We are proud of our response and the value that we've been able to deliver to the communities we serve. Since its onset, we have prioritized the health of our associates and clients, provided an outstanding support for SMEs to navigate through the difficult environment. We have deployed an effective use of the technology while accelerating our digital transformation. Amid the new normal, I would like to begin by emphasizing that the company has adopted a renewed focus on strengthening corporate governance, transparency, and accountability. We have made great strides to strengthen our corporate governance framework in line with international best practices. A clear example of this is separating the chairman and CEO's role, specifically in terms of executive pay, independence of the auditing committee, and corporate governance. The increased independence of the board committees and their additional capabilities in terms of oversight also stand out. The team will be strengthened in the coming months. In this regard, we have started the search for a new CFO. In parallel to implementing best corporate governance frameworks focusing on strong and robust processes, our strategy of prioritizing value over volume in our portfolio is gaining more traction. This is not just the right risk mitigation strategy in the current context. It will deepen our differentiated value proposition to investors over the long term. This is paired with improvements in collection that includes a wider adoption of data analytics and monitoring system under a proactive framework of customer relations. Outstanding in Central America, the launching of a payment point network through several strategic partnerships with a major commercial chain that is already bearing results in reducing the segment delinquency. Before moving on, I would like to take a moment here to clarify recent events. During the ordinary course of our annual financial review process for 2021, our auditors requested applying the strictest accounting criteria that only one credit within the SME's portfolio would be incorporated in the past due loan portfolio. It is important to note that the specific characteristics of these credits were previously communicated by the company to the market. Further, this request in no way implies or results in the restatements of audited financial results from previous years. As I explained it, was the results of the ordinary review process from preliminary 4Q numbers to audited financials. Of a total of more than 650 accounts that we have among the small and medium businesses, that one loan in particular explains the increase in the NPL rate, the cost of risk, and the coverage ratio. In addition, the rest of our portfolio in specific segments where we operate maintain NPL percentages far below our counterparts in the market. It's also important to note that as part of the same financial review process, our auditors also identified that the company was being overly rigorous in the matter of which we amortized assets related to the leasing activity. Previously, these assets were amortized over the term of the lease. However, following the suggestion of our independent auditors, these assets will be amortized over the duration of their service life. This modification created a positive effect on the amortization rubric and an increase in the fixed assets. This explains the fact that the company's profitability levels have been maintained without significant changes following the revisions of the accounting question. All in all, with regards to the shift in our NPL ratio caused by the single outlier loan I've explained, it is important to consider that it currently stands at 3.9%, expecting to see it in a range around the 3% over the second half of the year. Besides considering the explanation I just provided, I will just take a moment to analyze this metric at the light of delinquency reported by our peers and banking. Beer delinquency, as you might be aware, has already broken the glass ceiling of double-digit NPL rates in different products of credit consumption, such as credit cards. Therefore, we acknowledge the good work delivered by our endeavors to contain delinquency in the rest of our portfolio. Similarly, it is relevant to underscore that although the NPL ratio posted a 2% percentage points increase in the loan that cost is backed by collateral, saying that we are already striving to execute as we announced in our recent communications. We are targeting to achieve a higher cash and lower delinquency once these guarantees are monetized, pushing the NPL ratio significantly down, given the good health of the rest of our portfolio. When including this factor in the analysis, the NPL ratio lies around the 2.5%. Turning to our performance by business segment, although COVID-19 has surged in the countries where we operate, those trends have started to weaken as vaccination, particularly in the United States, has started to pick up, thus creating certain stability in our overall operating environment. In this regard, it is worth noting that the measures adopted in the past quarters to prevent the deterioration of their loan portfolio will remain in place until seeing stronger signs of recovery in the sectors we attend, even at the pace of the start of better demand dynamics. In this context, payroll origination improved on a sequential basis with a delinquency level below 2% and a rate considerably lower than the sector's average and comparable to banking. This performance was achieved at the back of the solid fundamentals of this legacy business and the increasing contribution of our commercial agreement with PAMSA, which we expect to ramp up over the year, as we are being able to tap into this extended footprint in northern Mexico. Used cars origination continues showing sound fundamentals as demand picks up before COVID-19 contagion risks of public transportation. Separately, used car Mexico collection remains sound, benefiting from the surging demand that allows us to select solid credit profiles, closing the quarter with an NPL rate of 2.5%. Meanwhile, used cars origination in the state have already reached pre-pandemic levels with a best-in-class non-performing loan ratio below 1%. Small and medium-sized enterprise origination in Mexico slowed down on a sequential basis, following our prudent approach of temporarily freezing credit, but relief programs are clearly stabilizing as this represents only 2% of the total portfolio. In contrast, SMEs United States remain advancing at good pace despite the effects of the winter storm in Texas, highlighting the growth of trend attained in collection coupled with a stable delinquency. Turning to InstaCredit, the combined effect of our widening outreach and higher efficiencies allows us to capitalize on the recovery of Costa Rica, Panama, and Nicaragua, as we have been able to benefit from the conservative approach of commercial banks, which are underserving clients that they use to attract and retain, allowing us to have better credit profiles than an average client. These dynamics are clearly reflected in the improvement of InstaCredit's profitability and delinquency of last reporting periods and move forward this quarter. On the financial front, we have already refinanced about 30% of 2021-year maturities, and counts on a solid cash position while firmly advanced towards the securitization of loan portfolio of our operations in the United States. This facility is expected to reach $130 million. I'm also happy to report that we closed as recently as April 22nd a refinancing with BNP Paribas for $50 million, this loan secured, and even more competitive interest rates than the original for a term of 1 year. This refinancing is a concrete signal of unequivocal confidence in our business model and substantive results. We are also getting positive feedback from key stakeholders, such as credit rating agencies and regulators, with which we've kept healthy and transparent relationships. It is worth noting that while proceeds spending of use from senior notes due 2028 are generating a negative carry, This effect will gradually decrease and fully end with the deployment of high-quality origination in the quarters to come. Wrapping up, the operating and financial stability consolidated in 2020 to face the pandemic, coupled with better macroeconomic prospects and a further progress on COVID-19 vaccination, makes us feel confident to preserve our asset quality in the short term and to capitalize on surging demand in the medium term. In this end, we clearly understand that the strength of our balance will be a paramount to succeed, as we expect that best grounded players of our segment, as it is Cres do Real, will take a stronger market position both from banking and other participants. Likewise, we are quite glad to see that the traction of our commercial agreement with FAMSA, which is already delivering a higher contribution than Credipiel, backed on the solid fundamentals of small Mexico, which is a region that has outstood as the most resilient in the country amid COVID-19, given its manufacturing orientation that is tightly integrated to the U.S. economy. To conclude, we are pleased to accomplish the 1 million clients mark in this quarter, while continuing to strive to weather the environment and strengthening our governance and key corporate practices to evolve from a defensive posture to a growth mood towards the year end. Rest assured that we are to arise stronger from the COVID-19 challenge. With this, I conclude my remarks and I hand the call over to Renata. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Carlos, and good morning, everyone. Starting with the P&L analysis, interest income for the first quarter 2021 increased 4% year over year to 2.8 billion pesos, mostly reflecting a certain degree the recovery of economic activity and incremental contribution generated by the acquisition of the loan portfolio from Banco FAMSA, as well as a foreign exchange gain experienced during the quarter. In this context, total income was up 14% to 3.2 billion pesos, benefited by both the annual growth in interest income and a higher amount recorded in other operating income. Interest expense amounted 1.5 billion pesos, increasing 39% year over year, propelled by a higher indebtedness. That financial margin stood at 1.3 billion pesos, decreasing 19% when compared to that of the first quarter 2020, as a result of a combined effect of higher interest expenses and a negative carry. Net provision for loan losses totaled 490 million pesos, increasing 6.5% year over year, primarily reflecting the additional allowances due to face COVID-19 during 2020. Although the coverage ratio decreased to 118% from 219% in the first quarter 2020 due to a larger past due balance that offset the creation of provisions, we deem this level suitable to cover potential losses. In contrast, cost of risk increased 10 basis points to 3.8%. Administrative and promotional expenses were up 16% on an annual basis, amounting 895 million pesos. Net income totaled 89 million pesos compared to 306 million in the first quarter 20, following the effect of the negative carry and a non-recurring loss in intermediation income related to a derivative unwinding by the prepayment of a dollar-denominated credit line. Excluding non-recurring effects, net income should be 125 million pesos. Return on average equity was 2.1% as of quarter end, and when excluding the perpetual notes, it attained 2.9%. Return on average assets stood at 0.5%. Capitalization dropped 7 percentage points from 38.4% in the first quarter 20 to 31.4% as of quarter end. Average cost of funds was 11.2% compared to 9.4% registered in the same period last year, mostly due to a negative carry and to a lesser extent to certain refinancing credits of high spreads. Excluding the negative carry, the cost of funds was 10.4%. Here it's worth noting that worldwide, the low interest rate cycle may be coming to an end this year at the light of inflationary concerns. In this sense, we'll remain monitoring the monetary policy of relevant central banks to quickly recalibrate our funding strategy. Breaking down credit portfolios, the total portfolio expanded 9.8% to 54.7 billion pesos at the end of the quarter, primarily driven by the growth achieved at payroll and SMEs. Our consolidated non-performing loan ratio was up to 3.9% this quarter, following the recording of a specific non-performing loan in SMEs whose subjacent collaterals are undergoing due execution and monetization processes. On payroll, the loan portfolio totaled almost 32 billion pesos, increasing 12% supported by our commercial agreement with FAMSA and by the acquisition of a portfolio of Banco FAMSA. Non-performing loan ratio of this segment remains stable at 1.7%. SMEs posted an annual growth rate of 18.8% to reach 12.5 billion pesos. As was the case of the previous quarter, the growth rate of this segment declined when compared to pre-pandemic levels, following a softer business activity at all markets we serve, coupled with the implementation of selective origination standards aimed at downsizing our exposure to at-risk sectors. The non-performing ratio of this segment increased to 12%, following the specific delinquency of a single loan that has been already discussed, having an overall stability on the other assets of the portfolio. Non-performing loan of this segment is expected to gradually stabilize over the coming periods. In the same approach of asset quality preservation, used cars portfolio posted a slight growth of almost 1% on an annual basis, amounting to 4.1 billion pesos, while posted a 30 basis points annual contraction in its non-performing loan ratio, which stood at 1.5%. Instacredit's loan portfolio amounted to 5.2 billion pesos, down 14% on an annual basis, but delivering an incremental profitability. It is important to note that SMEs Mexico portfolio weighting the total loan portfolio is expected to decrease in line with our action plan oriented to most profitable segments. Moving to the balance sheet, as of the end of first quarter 2021, total assets amounted 77.2 billion pesos, 6% higher than that record last year, in line with the growth recorded at the consolidated portfolio and the comprehensive execution of funding and hedging initiatives over the last 12 months. Total debt increased 12% year over year to 56.9 billion pesos following the placement of senior notes due 2028 and other financing activities conducted over the last 12 months, including the subscription of the DFC credit facility. Finally, stockholders' equity reached 17 billion pesos, decreasing 10% year over year. With this, I conclude my remarks. Now let me turn back the call to the operator to open the line for Q&A.
Ladies and gentlemen, I apologize for the technical difficulties, but we'll go ahead with the Q&A session. In order to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad at this time. If you're using a speakerphone, please make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. Your first question comes from the line of Ernesto Gabilanavo with Bank of America. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, good morning, Angel, Carlos, and Renata. Thanks for your presentation. And Carlos, congrats on your new position. As you know, after the restatement of your financial statements, there have been a lot of questions coming from investors. So let me make you some of those questions. The first one is the timing. Why after Alfa Credit's restatement, and why now, as in the past, you haven't done so much adjustments? Today, there were some adjustments in the balance sheet, mainly related to asset quality. There was no impact in net earnings, but with a lot of moving parts. So I just want to understand this. And then my second question is on the deterioration of the specific SME clients. We are receiving concerns of how diversified is this portfolio and how is the size of your top 10 clients in this portfolio? Because it was very surprising that only one client doubled the NPL ratio from 1.8 to 3.3%. Thank you.
Hi, Ernesto. And first, I'm sorry for this inconvenience with the technical issue. It's completely related to us. But let me address your question, your first question. It's completely unrelated. It's completely unrelated because on the first hand, we didn't restate any of the, we didn't restate financials. The change was due, you know, 40 figures were preliminary figures, and basically that's what happened. I mean, the full financial statements were due in that date, and basically that's what happened. I mean, we were working with preliminary, the 4Q figures were preliminary financial statements, and let me be very clear about this. There was no restatement whatsoever. I mean, this is, and the thing that happened just after Alpha Credit was nothing related to us. It was basically because that day, on Friday, we held a shareholders meeting over here in Mexico, and basically the financials were released that night. And basically that's the thing about it. I mean, and coming to your second question, and coming to your second question of this particular client that we've been disclosing from the beginning of the year, I mean, what is very important to point out is that what makes unusual this customer is that it didn't pay, right? I mean, over the ordinary course of business, we have customers, all sorts of customers, and with different characteristics and so on. And basically, this is the only the thing that makes this particular loan outlier is because it didn't pay. What we have been doing lately, and those are part of the changes that we are having here at the company, is to strengthen our processes, enforce the risk analysis and risk management as well, and that's basically where we are standing, you know, in order of not having these type of problems in the future. Strengthening of the, you know, the credit committees, both internal and the board of directors credit committee as well. So basically, that's where we are standing. But we have been very, since the onset of this situation, we have been very transparent about this particular customer, and that's what we intend to do in the future is to focus on having the right processes, to strengthen them, and bad business decisions are a part of our business. So basically, that's what I can tell you about this particular loan.
Perfect. Thank you, Carlos. And then let me make you another question that I got related to other receivables. We have been seeing that the increase from around 5 billion pesos to 9 billion pesos in the last year and a half. I believe this is because you provide upfront some cash to your payroll loan distributors to originate the loans. And I think that you agreed with the Social Security Institution, the IMSS, to provide a grace period for your client due to the pandemic, and that you will receive that money after the maturity of the payroll loans. Mm-hmm. And then you will be able to reduce the other receivable account. So please let me know if this is really what is happening in the increase of other receivables, and where do you have the bulk of payroll loans maturing in order to see when should we see the receivable accounts being collected?
Right. I mean, if you think of the largest portion of that, of the other account receivable, is completely associated to the duration of the book, of the payroll book. So in that sense, what would happen if today, for example, we stop origination altogether, that particular account, the income paid in advance to distributors, would, you know, naturally unwind right? So this is the largest portion of it, even though there was a jump associated, you know, with the explanation that you gave, you know, that it is related to the IMSS and so on and so forth. This particular item is associated to the duration of the loan. That's very important to mention. If you look at the different lines, specifically in the other accounts receivable, there was a jump in the receivables from subsidiaries. And this jump that you get to see over there was due to the consolidation of CRA, which was not performed at the beginning, at the end of first Q20, and it was done in the second quarter. So if you look at that spike, which amounts roughly a billion pesos, in there what you have are, you know, number of different things. For example, you have a trust, you have VAT that's supposed to be collected, you know, associated to the leasing activities and so on. But if you look, you know, other than this effect that is mostly explained by the consolidation of Crédito Real Arrendamiento, the other lines have rather performed, the other lines have instead performed associated with the nature of the business, you know, in particular the payroll business.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Carlos.
Thank you, Ernesto.
Your next question comes from the line of Carlos Alcaraz with Appalachian Analysis. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, everyone. Thank you for the call. I have two questions. The first one is, you said cars, we can see a higher NPL of 1.5 from 0.9% during the last quarter of the 2020. Which was the cause of this increase? And the second one is, where do you see this NPL in the future? Thank you.
I mean, sorry, I missed in what line you said? Excuse me? The NPL ratio of what you're saying?
The NPL of 1.5 from 0.9 during the last quarter of 2020. Which was the cause of this increase?
Yes, the increase on the consolidated loan portfolio was mainly on the SMEs line, which in particular is related to one single customer, which we already communicate, which was included on the 2020 financial statements as a non-performing loan, and right now we are still having that client on the non-performing loan ratio. That's why you could see an increase on the SMEs line, which also brought out of the consolidated loan portfolio.
Okay, where do you see this NPL in the future?
I mean, if you isolate the effect of this particular customer, it could be something in the range of the 2.5, 2.6. I mean, that's very important to stress. So basically what we are doing right now, we are focusing, the focus for this year clearly is going to be over asset performance. So basically what I'm saying is that if I have to ask you, if I have to answer you this, you know, from an operational perspective, is that all the efforts will be focused over there, and we have the adequate tools to track and solve this and solve the situation that we are currently facing. But that's going to depend on the, you know, on the length of the judiciary process and things like that. But anyway, by the end of the year, I would expect the NPLs to be something around the 3%, as I already mentioned in the given my opening statement.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Nicolas Riva with Bank of America. Please proceed with your question.
Thanks for the chance to ask questions, and congrats again, Carlos, on the new responsibilities. I have three questions. The first one, following up on what Ernesto asked before about the changes to the fourth quarter figures. So one thing I notice is the NPLs increased by roughly 700 million pesos, right? But the loan loss reserves in the balance sheet barely moved. So that tells me that, or that suggests that you didn't book much additional provisions for this SME client. And first of all, is that a correct assessment? And second, how much have you provisioned for this loan, which is about $35 million? That's my first question. Second question.
Nicolas, let me address that one. You want me to address that one?
Yeah,
So first, what I can tell you is that the increase in the provisions made at the end of the 4Q amounted roughly 185 million pesos. That was the change that was increased in the provision for that particular loan. If you look at the, you know, expected losses, you know, provisioning, the likelihood of default of that particular loan is to that 15%. When that was moved, was recorded as an NPL, that likelihood of default increased from the 15% to the 45%, and this is basically the increase that I'm saying, those 185 million pesos. So basically, out of that, you know, out of the 695 million pesos of that particular loan are roughly 400 million that are already provisioned. The changes that you get to see, the effect that this has over the coverage ratio is very visible. If you look at the coverage ratio, it went down basically 100 points, and this is because of the increase in the NPL. This is because of the increase of the NPL. So it is very important to mention that expected losses are different than NPLs. And basically, the expected loss for that particular loan stands at 45%. And whereas on the NPL side, it's accounted at 100%. I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. Okay, so you have covered 45% of this particular loan. And so you could have to book additional provisions because there are 55% which hasn't been provisioned for. But I would assume that, I mean, you said in the earnings report you have some guarantee, some collateral on this loan. And then the differential is what you expect to collect. Okay.
Correct. So in that regard, the maximum exposure that we will hold at the time would be the difference, roughly another 50%. The more we collect, the better the percentage is going to be.
Carlos, is there any color you can provide us in terms of what's that collateral and the timing in terms of collecting on that collateral?
Sorry, we cannot provide so much information about that one. What I can tell you is that there were collaterals and that particular loan is under litigation at this point.
Okay, understood. My second question, Carlos, on I wanted to ask you something related to Alpha Credit, and it's would you be interested in acquiring some of the payroll loans or contract agreements held by Alpha, and also something else related to this. In January, you had acquired this portfolio of payroll loans from Banco FAMSA. Can you tell us the percentage that you paid of that loan portfolio? In other words, what was the haircut to that loan portfolio? Was it 50%? Was it 40%? Roughly. And then I have a last question.
Look. I cannot provide much color on the second part of your question. I'm not able to disclose that part. What I can tell you is that was one of the important drivers for the increase in the income under the income line came from that particular, you know, from that particular portfolio. So basically what I'm trying to say is that was definitely a good deal. When you ask me about Alpha, I'm not getting too much into that. I mean, we are always looking for opportunities for different portfolios, such as what we did with FAMSA, and it would be interesting for us, you know, to see whether there's something interesting for us, whether there's something that we could buy out. In that sense, what I can be very emphatic is that we do not buy contracts. Crédito Real has no contracts with any government agencies whatsoever, and this is because we have a different business model than theirs. I mean, our different, whereas they have a vertical, you know, an integrated platform, We rely on distributors, and that makes a big, big difference. And probably the most visible and the important one at this point is that we have no contracts whatsoever, and we have different assets, no? And we have different assets as well.
Understood. Carlos, and my last question, looking at the covenants in some of your bank debt, those include a 4% NPL ratio and a 3.5 times debt to equity. Right now, you're very close to those metrics, 3.9 NPL ratio. There's another 2% under relief. And then you're at 3.3 times debt to equity. Has this issue been raised by any of your lenders, or what are your thoughts about this topic?
Look, I mean, for starters, we are very conscious. We are very conscious about the situation. But we have tools to solve this. And basically, let me start, you know, one of the advantages that we have at this point is the breakdown of our book. So what I'm trying to say is that as long as we continue to outweigh this particular fraction of our portfolio, speaking about the SME portfolio, I mean, we could dilute the effect over the NPLs, right? We could dilute a little bit the effect over the NPLs. Finally, I mean, what I mentioned already before is that even though from the operational perspective, we are focusing all our, you know, collections efforts are focused on, you know, on these particular credits and other lines of credit and other lines of collections, what is important to stress at this point is that the intention that the company has for this year is that we should not increase the leverage at all for this year. We are going to rely on our own resources, and probably in that same sense, what is very important to address is that if you look at the amount that we hold in cash or cash and equivalents right now, roughly 250 million, I mean, we are in a very good position. So what I'm saying is that we could grow the book, if you think in terms of liquidity, we could grow the book by something around the 7 or 8%, still growing the book 7 to 8% without getting new money whatsoever. And finally, basically what I'm trying to say in short, as a summary, is that we have no liquidity issues. We have no risks of refinancing. I mean, a good example of this is what we performed last week, as recent as last week with BNP Paribas. And we believe that the experiences that brought to us last year, refinancing without accessing the market, put us in a very good position. And finally, if worse comes to worst, we could write that particular loan off and lower the NPL ratio, you know, to the 2.5% range or something like that. I understand that this would have a negative effect on the P&L, but what we are aiming right now is to preserve the financial stability and the solidness of our balance sheet.
Thanks, Carlos. One last question, if I may. On collections, you mentioned the collections on the entire loan book of 7.8 billion pesos this quarter. Can you tell us what were the collections specifically in the payroll portfolio? Because I saw the payroll portfolio increased by 2.3 billion pesos, and that was exactly the amount of originations in the loan book. So I was wondering how much did you collect actually on the payroll loan book?
Hi, Nicolas. Actually, the collections from payroll remain rather stable. They were in line with the collections we have throughout 2020. The decrease we experienced on the collections during the quarter came specifically from the SME segment. I think it's also important to mention that given that, for example, there are on the factoring side right now, we are very limited and not originating. This kind of short-term revolving loans that we used to grant used to help on the collection rates, and right now we are not having that effect.
Okay, thanks very much, Renata and Carlos.
Thank you, Nicolas.
Your next question comes from the line of John Hoff with Mizuho. Please proceed with your question.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Well, good afternoon. Well, depends on where we are. Good afternoon. Congratulations again, Carlos, on the new role, and sorry to see Angel go, and hello, Renato. Hey, Carlos, in the beginning of the call, you get in your intro, you said you expect NPLs to be around what in the second half of the year, just to confirm that number?
Yeah, something around the 3%.
Okay. And, you know, with the relief programs rolling off, you know, do we expect any, what could be any sort of expectation of the NPLs into the second quarter and into maybe the third quarter?
I'd say it's going to remain rather stable. I think we're making some progress. I mean, I'm not going to get into this, you know, outlier that we've been speaking throughout the call, you know, in particular because we are, you know, as I mentioned, there's a judiciary process in place, and that might be lengthy. However, the progresses that we are seeing in the other lines that are already non-performing, I feel confident about that. So even though it could be rather stable, probably we are going to be on the, I don't know, probably it's going to be under the range of the 3.5 or something like that. If you look at our presentation, if you look at the earnings release, there is a clear improvement in the different lines. There's an improvement in the used cars, there's an improvement in Central America, and there's an improvement in the other lines of business. The only one that's missing is on the SME, and that's exactly where we are focusing all our efforts. So I would say that if we manage to accomplish it, there's going to be an improvement in the second, not a major improvement in the second Q, but there's going to be an improvement.
Yeah. In terms of that loan that you discussed, did you actually disclose the actual amount? You know, is it 700 million pesos or 750 million pesos? Is it in there? Or?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, we disclosed it at the beginning of the year. I mean, we were in the middle of the, you know, of issuing the 2028. And, we disclosed that particular loan. I mean, probably what is important to highlight at this point is that we do not have a systemic issue. We do not have a systemic condition. We are speaking of isolated cases, and we are addressing it, and we are addressing them consistently. So basically, that would be kind of the message that I'm trying to convey here to you.
Yeah. Do you have a number? If you took out that one item, what would your NPLs be without that loan?
Sorry, John, I didn't get it.
If you took out that one loan that increased your NPLs, what would your NPLs be this quarter? Is it? I mean, I know it's not the big jump that we see, but it would be slightly higher. I'm just wondering what that number would be.
Yeah, 2.5. 2.5, and probably the best way to isolate this effect is if you think in terms of the 4Q figures, that the before mentioned 4Q figures, it went up from the 1.8 to the 3.3 for this particular item. So basically, if we remove it with the first Q figures, it would be something around the 2.5%.
Okay. My other question is about this, the foreclosed assets line item. At what point does this loan move down to the foreclosed assets? I mean, or does it, you know, not?
Do you understand very well, but let me speak to you about that particular line of the foreclosed assets. What we did at the end of the year in order, I mean, normally, let me put it this way. I mean, the focus on the focus for our commercial, our collection efforts has always been the cash. However, when we face situations such as the ones we faced last year, in some particular cases in which we believe that getting the cash is not going to be as manageable, we try to, you know, reach and we negotiate with the customers in order to solve the situation, and that's basically what we did. We repossess some assets, we foreclose some assets in the amount of that. So the most important part, I mean, the effect that these foreclosed assets have is there's a change in the, you know, in the, if you look at the asset on the asset side of the balance sheet, there is a change. You remove it from the portfolio line and you move it into the foreclosed assets. In order to do that, you have to have, you know, the right appraisals. You have to have, you know, you have to test them for impairment on a regular basis. And more importantly, you have to be able to monetize them fast. So, as similar as the, you know, on a different priority is to monetize all those assets. And I definitely believe that we are going to see an improvement in that particular line during the second queue. So basically, to put it in short, we strive to collect and maximize these collections as of the second queue, and that's what we are aiming.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. And one last follow-up is, you know, per one of the gentlemen before me asking, we brought up the SME portfolio, and you have this one loan that was an issue. Is there any other loans that you have identified that are potentially issues or, you know, that could be an issue in coming quarters? Not that we'll have a surprise, but, you know, that they're starting to run into that issue.
I mean, as I mentioned before when I was answering Ernesto, what makes this, the extraordinary nature of this particular credit was the default. Nothing else. So basically the focus and the measures that we've taken are in the sense of strengthening in all our credit analysis, the risk management, and so on and so forth in order of not having these outliers. But that's where we are standing. But but what is very important and the message to convey is that the default was the extraordinary feature about this particular credit.
And you mentioned your funding is fine and you don't need to originate, but can you talk about any potential refinancings you need to do for the rest of the year, for the rest of the 2021?
No, based on our on last year's experience, we believe that we will be able to roll, you know, all the amortizations over. And right now we are focusing on refinancing the CHF as of February 2022. That's basically what we are aiming. As I mentioned, you know, the liquidity of the company is solid enough.
Very strong.
To being able to grow 7 to 8% without getting new money. So basically that's where we are standing, you know?
Yeah. Thank you, Carlos.
Right. Thank you, John. Thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Nick Dimitrov with Morgan Stanley Investment Management. Please proceed with your question.
Good afternoon, guys. A lot of my questions have been already asked, but I still have a couple of questions. So, Carlos, I was looking at your capital, tangible equity to tangible assets, excluding the perpetuals. And that ratio has been grinding down for a few years now. So currently it's in the 12% area. When I compare Crédito Real to Banorte or Bancomer, that same metric for these two banks is in the 10-10.5% area, right? And these are much larger entities that are being regulated, more profitable, and so on and so on. I know that we've been doing, you know, some share buybacks. They've been relatively small, but nonetheless, how do you think about capital? And again, this is somewhat related to the question that Nick asked earlier regarding your leverage. Do you believe that you need to raise capital?
Not at this time. Not at this time. And the way we see capitalization and the way we see capitalization, if you want, is in terms of risk-adjusted capitalization consistent with rating agencies. Basically, that's one key element. If you think in those terms, The risk-adjusted capitalization stands something around 11% or something, and in order of not having, you know, at least for what a standard push methodology is concerned, in order of not having, not being downgraded or put on a credit watch or anything, just your risk-adjusted capitalization needs to stand above the 10%, so we are well above. However, I mean, one of the key aspects, the rationale behind the decision of not increasing the leverage at all this year, comes from the side of protecting the capitalization, and that's what we are aiming now. That's definitely what we are aiming, protecting the capitalization, not over-leveraging the customers, and more importantly, you know, the focus for this year has to be capital allocation, efficient capital allocation. So instead of, and that's something that we mentioned at some point, instead of growing, what we need is making more money in order to strengthen the capitalization. If this is accomplished, I think we'll be okay for the next couple of years. But that's what we, that's where we are aiming at this point. What I'm saying is, to put it briefly, is a more, what we are going to see in the next couple of years is going to be a more disciplined growth. That's basically what we are aiming.
Got it. Regarding making more money, your margins have been under pressure even prior to COVID-19, and some of this has changed in the business mix, but there were others, there was other things going on. When I look at your net interest margin in Q1, I calculated it roughly 10.5% area, so it continued to decline, although, you know, some of that decline is related to the issuance of the new dollar bond.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of Q4, you mentioned that you expect the net interest margin to rebound to the 14% area by year-end 2021, which very much ties with what you just said, that you want to emphasize quality versus quantity. Do you still see the net interest margin recovering to 14% by year end 2021?
Yes, and let me tell you why I see that.
Okay.
If you think about the, negative carry, which amounted roughly 100 million, 110 million, or something like that, that's roughly, that amounts for roughly 2% of the pressure over the NIM. So expecting to deploy those resources by the end of the year, you won't be having that 2%. So that puts you on the 12% range plus. The second initiative, which is very, very important as well, you know, in order of being, you know, of boosting the NIM, is going to be to move to change the concentration that we currently have on the SMEs portfolio, as of the end of the quarter, it stands at the 20 plus percent range. If we manage to, you know, unwind that to something around the 15% range, which is something we believe that we could do this same year, and to compensate these with the different lines of business with higher interest rates, such as payroll or such as the used cars here in Mexico, where we see enormous potential in both businesses. I mean, I definitely believe that only by this product mix and the deployment of all the resources that we currently have, we could be something around, the NIM could be standing close to the 14% or probably a little bit higher. So basically, that's what we are doing.
Okay. Makes sense. And one last question. I'm going to revert back to that problematic loan. I think it, in dollar terms, it's around $30 to $32 million. I was a little bit surprised by the size of the loan. I thought your SME book was primarily leasing and a little bit of working capital loans, generally kind of more granular than the $32 million loan that kind of came up as being problematic. What's happening? Is this loan like one-off in terms of size, or a lot of the loans that you originated are kind of roughly in the same ballpark in terms of size?
No. In that sense, yes, it's above the average. That definitely, that was above the average.
However, I mean, as I have stated, you know, during the call, you know, the particular feature about this one was the default, right? Was the default.
Yeah.
So basically, what I'm heading to is the, I mean, bad business decisions we made on a recurrent basis. So what we are now aiming is to strengthen all the origination procedures, specifically for the SMEs business altogether, in order to minimize them, realizing that bad decisions are, you know, day-to-day thing. Just we are trying to minimize them. That's what we are aiming.
Okay, got it. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you, Nick.
Your next question comes from the line of Nandana Shenoy with BTIG. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, good afternoon. I just had a quick question on your opening statement under the relevant development. You said your joint venture with Banco FAMSA, you've got the receivables coming through an SPV with PromoCap and an investment fund managed by Credit Suisse. Can you please walk me through that structure, particularly around the setup of the trust? Is it a single trust? Is it a double trust structure? Do any third parties have access to the SPVs? And who's responsible for the due diligence behind the receivables and invoices?
Yeah, I mean, basically, for starters, I mean, if you think that particular portfolio, the FAMSA's portfolio, FAMSA's payroll portfolio, was something around 11 billion pesos at the beginning of the thing. You know, this whole situation started at the beginning of July last year. So what happened is, if you think in those terms, roughly, you know, half a billion, that was too big for us. That was too big for us, and that would have put a lot of pressure over the capitalization. So that's why one of the key aspects was looking for partners, and that's what we did, a couple of players. And basically, you know, in order of not having pressure over the capitalization, that's how we ended up, you know, setting this SPV up. And that's basically the rationale behind that. What's going to be the duration for that particular SPV? It's probably going to be more related to the, you know, to the duration of this portfolio and the potential new loans that we could be, you know, granting. That's probably 2 or 3 years, and that's it. What I can tell you, I mean, and something that's proven to be right, is that this was a great business decision. Definitely was a great business decision, because not only we gained access to the northern states in payroll, which were not, you know, the core in our footprint, but definitely net income-wise, it was a great business decision.
Okay, but do you have details in terms of how the SPV is set up? Is it one SPV? Is it strictly a pass-through structure? Do any third parties have access to the cash flows?
You know, I cannot provide you those details, and we can reach out for you to give you further color on this offline.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from line of Matt Dratch with Millennium. Please proceed with your question.
Hey guys, can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Hello? Okay, great. So I actually have a question on the payroll section. It looks like the loan portfolio increased almost exactly proportionally with the stated origination of around 2.3 billion pesos, if I read that correctly. So this kind of implies there were almost zero collections. Like, how should we think about that?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the origination, if I understood correctly, the origination that what you are seeing is the origination for the first Q in the as of the payroll amounted roughly 2.3 billion, right?
Mm-hmm.
That was your question? Yeah, and basically
the thing
is that we are over there in that figure, the 2.3 billion, we are incorporating something roughly about a billion pesos is the was the bottom of this Ramsa portfolio. Just to be, you know, just to give you a time frame about the transaction, that was completed on January the 9th, if I recall correctly. That was completed on January the 9th and amounted on our side roughly ₱1 billion. So basically, that's what you see the difference, or you could understand as an inconsistency in terms of the origination, and on the other hand, in the size of the portfolio. But this is the case.
Okay, and then just one more. Where do you stand on the CRUSA loan from Wells Fargo? It looks like the debt equity has a 2.25 times limit, and are the proceeds from the ABS deal to repay that lender, or what sort of where do you stand on that covenant?
No, look, I mean, what I can tell you about that particular transaction is that it's definitely a landmark transaction for the company. I mean, we are lowering the cost of funds dramatically, and that's going to be an important improvement in the terms of the cost of funds for the company, because we are, you know, improving something around 200 basis or something like that, something within that range. So that's going to be the most visible effect over the next few, you know, the next few customers. And basically, what I can tell you about that is that it's an ABL facility, basically.
Oh, okay. And then just thinking about, like, the NPL, if you adjust for foreclosed assets and charge-offs and relief programs, is the sort of true NPL higher than the 3.9? Like, so in other words, like, there's all these other types of assets that you don't calculate as NPLs, but, like, if we broadly think about NPLs as, you know, people who can't pay, isn't it high? I'm new to this credit, so I'm just curious.
Yeah, I mean, definitely probably the best way to see it is, you know, with all the figures available. I mean, if you think in terms of cost of risk, you get to see, you know, you get to see the charge-offs over there in the cost of risk, also with the coverage ratio, you know. The decline in the coverage ratio was explained because an increase of the NPL. However, on the other side, I mean, thinking about the foreclosed assets, I would refer to, you know, the rating agency's methodology. If you cannot monetize them, you know, fast enough, I mean, what I'm saying is that if you cannot monetize them within months of having those foreclosed assets, then those amounts as an NPL, you know, for standard, for rating agencies in particular, for rating agencies' methodology. But that's it.
Right. Okay. And then just lastly on that Wells Fargo thing, I was just, you know, thinking through as you were speaking on the response. Is the Wells Fargo loan being repaid from the ABS proceeds?
Yes.
It is. Is that because it's a current maturity, or is it because it's in technical default?
You know, since we are about to close that transaction today, I could provide you more color next week. Renata will reach out to provide you further color on that one. But what I can tell you is that as of now, you know, the main benefit is that it's going to be a major improvement in terms of the cost of funds and a more sophisticated treasury on that particular business. So we are making, definitely, we are happy with the team, and we are making sound progresses in the business in the States.
Oh, okay, so do we lose the value of the securitized portfolio but not get extra cash to the company? Like, how does that work?
You basically pay down debt and you have the cash for it.
Huh. Okay. All right. That's it for me. I appreciate your time.
Take care. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Amer Iwana with Imperial Capital. Please proceed with your question.
Guys, thank you for taking my question. I have two questions. One, the upcoming maturity in Feb of next year, $170 million. What is the plan? You sort of alluded to, you know, trying to do something with it, whether Are you going to tap the markets? You do have a fair amount of cash and cash investments on the book. Would you be using those? And my second question is regarding liquidity of the company. Where does it stand? You did raise a fair amount of cash in the quarter through your bond issuance. And, you know, we're just trying to bridge exactly what happened in the quarter with cash. You know, what was the cash burn in the quarter is the second question.
Right. I mean, if you think in terms of refinancing, since the outset, I mean, when, you know, consistent with the strategy of differentiating ourselves of the different players in the sector, I mean, we intended to tap different markets, and that was the reason behind, you know, issuing in Swiss, in the CHF, in the euro, the dollars, and the local markets. The goal was, you know, differentiating ourselves from the other players in the NBFI space. As for, you know, so having that in mind, the intention would be to refinance that CHF in the Swiss market again. However, we acknowledge that given the situation that we are currently living, I mean, probably the markets are going to be, you know, shut for a while, as they were during last year. So basically what we are, you know, what we are trying to do is, you know, focusing on the capital allocation, on profitability, and so on, is to build up our capitalization and to be ready whenever the market opens, you know, for refinancing, in particular, the CHF bond. That's basically our view right now, you know, focusing on capital allocation, focusing on asset quality, and so on and so forth, and that's basically going to be the idea. How are we planning to use the cash? Well, at this point, we feel comfortable. I mean, we and considering the atmosphere, having that amount of cash definitely puts us on the right position. That gives us the flexibility. That brings us definitely opportunities. And that's basically where we are standing. So to put it shortly, we, having this cash, puts us in a place where we don't see refi problems, where we see, you know, a natural form of strengthening our financials, and that's the good opportunity that's the opportunity that where we are standing. In terms of the cash burn, I mean, what I can tell you is that during the first year, well, we have net income, positive net income, so there was no cash to burn. We got a couple of facilities. We issued the 2028 worth $500 million. Out of those, roughly $290 million, we tendered for the 23s in order to having a much better debt profile. And we also got $100 million from the DFC. So basically, what we, you know, in terms of liquidity, the best way I find to describe the liquidity of the company, the position of the company, is that we do not need new money in order to grow 7%. So I think that's a good way to describe the cash position of the company. We generate a lot of cash.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Andy Taylor with Carnade. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, thanks. I guess it's a couple of questions. I guess, are all of your bank facilities fully drawn?
Right, I get it. We have the fully drawn facilities. If you look at the earnings release in terms of availabilities, in terms of banks facilities, let me get that info right now. So right now it's about 10%. I think there are undrawn facilities, 10 or 15%, something like that, are undrawn facilities. As far as if I recall correctly, we normally have drawn something around the 90%, and as of today, I believe that we are a little bit shorter than that. I think it's more like in the sense of 85% or something. At least on the important ones, they are drawn, most of them, they are fully drawn. In the consolidated, it should be something around the 85-90%. But let me check and get back to you on that one.
Okay, I guess the question I'm trying to understand is, if you have some liquidity there and you're carrying all this extra cash and it's creating a 2% negative, you know, headline to interest income, why not use that cash, pay down your facilities, avoid this negative yield, and just draw the cash back later? You know, you just said you generate a lot of cash. You're carrying excess cash. You have access to liquidity. Why burden yourself with the extra interest expense that you're carrying by keeping cash up?
Basically because of the flexibility that having the cash provides us. That's basically the main reason for that. So in that regard, we are assessing the best use of that cash. Remember that we are coming out of the 2020 where, you know, markets were closed. You know, market was closed for, you know, the entire year for us. And basically we're, you know, to put it short, assessing the best use of that cash. You know, under the current environment, it is what we value the most are the flexibility in order to capitalize on opportunities.
I guess I would just think that if you have the facilities, you could pull it back if you need it. But, okay. The other question I had was on the acquisition of the payroll loans in January, sort of building off a question that was asked earlier. I think the gentleman was trying to figure out what purchase price you guys bought them at. You said you can't get into it for detail purposes. Can you at least tell us, are the stated balances on the balance sheet consistent with the purchase price, or were they written up to notional stated balances?
Yes, actually what we are registering in our loan portfolio is basically the purchase price we paid for our correspondence part of that portfolio.
Okay, thank you. And can you guys tell us, and the other part I'm just trying to understand, big picture, your efficiency ratio is going up, which means your expenses and other sorts of things are going up. Your NPLs are up, even without the SME loan, they're up a little bit. Your coverage ratios are down, your borrow costs are up, and your covenant ratios are close to being triggered. Why are you growing the balance sheet into that? Why wouldn't you shrink the balance sheet and sort of turn it into cash and become more liquid?
Look, I mean, I could elaborate on the pressure over the NIM. You are right. I mean, and the effect that this has over the efficiency ratio. Some of it is explained, as we said, of the negative carry that we explained already. Look, and you are right. I mean, one of the key aspects as of this year, and it is not only as of this year, as of the end of last year, is reassessing growth. So basically, I mean, what is important about this is that in the past the story of Crédito Real was, you know, the story of Crédito Real was a history of growth. Basically, we are now focusing on growing more efficiently, and that's basically where we are standing. I mean, we are not discarding. We are not discarding asset sales, for example. We are refocusing just on the use of our capital. I mean, and this is what the idea that I was trying to convey when I say that you will see a more disciplined growth. especially this comes out as, you know, about all the challenges that we've been facing, including the COVID and so on and so forth. So basically, we are reassessing growth in order of growing in a more disciplined way.
I guess I'm asking, I think, a slightly different question. Why are you growing? You mentioned that your tangible, the tangible equity is getting low. You have all of this money, you said, out to other receivables and affiliates as like a precursor to origination. Why not shrink the company and liquefy the company and sort of improve these ratios and sort of address these concerns that, you know, people are having and improve your ratios? They're all really strong.
And that's exactly what we intend to do when we say that we will refocus our capital on what makes sense. I mean, if you think the rationale behind, you know, trying to unwind the book, you know, to lower the concentration from the 22% we currently have on the SMEs into more efficient portfolios such as the payroll or such as the used cars, that would lead to improvements in all the different metrics. So that's basically what we are aiming. And all of this to say that I agree completely with you and that we are doing, right? And that's exactly what we are doing, you know, refocusing, you know, focusing on a capital allocation. And that's something that we are considering as we speak, no, in order to improve the ratios.
Okay. I mean, it sounds like you're optimizing with mix. I understood that comment before about SME and payroll. I'm saying, why not just like shrink the book 25% or something and like really try to liquefy things? Or if there's all this money that's kind of spent out and sort of into the affiliates and whatnot. But can you also just real quick, can you run me through why you have to send money to off balance sheet affiliates ahead of originating loans to such a great degree? I don't fully understand that. Why you have to invest?
Are you speaking about the SPV? About the FAMSA deal and the SPV? Or
no,
I don't get
no.
You're speaking about. Are you speaking about the other receivables?
Yes. So why do you have to?
The other receivables, that's related to the. That's related to the payroll business. It's a rebate, if you want. I mean, if you think that the sales forces get paid on a daily basis, something around 10 to 15%, well, basically, we advance some cash in order for them to pay the sales forces. That's basically how the business works. And that's, the explanation of that particular line, when I spoke about the other receivables, was basically that it is entirely associated to the duration of the book. If you unwind the book, that line unwinds naturally. But basically, you advance that money in order for them to pay the sales forces. And that's how it is.
I get that there's origination fees. And so I guess it just begs the question, again, why burden yourself with all this extra interest expense and the cash drag while forwarding origination fees to people? Like, why not just stop doing that and sort of allow cash to collect and sort of improve the book?
By unwinding the book?
By unwinding the growth of the book. Stop origination, stop sending 10 to 15% out and sort of just collect, let cash build up, demonstrate that everything is working.
Yes, I mean, I guess that we are jumping from one side to the other. If you think about the payroll particular business, if we do not advance that money, they simply do not originate. I mean, because that money is used to pay the sales forces. That's about it. On the other end, I mean, that's what we intend to do in the most efficient, you know, capital-wise, the most efficient products such as the SME. That's basically what we intend to do. But those are, you know, two different products with two different dynamics.
It just seems like you're spending money to push your ratios down. And if you were to stop spending money to originate, you would put pressure off of your – if everything works according to plan, you would actually save money and allow your ratios to improve. But I guess
correct. Understood.
Okay. That's all I have for the moment. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Lamer Salah with Barings. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, good morning, Carlos. Hello, Renata. Thank you very much for your time. Just a few questions from my end. So the first question is with regards to that capitalization. I mean, obviously, the market is not taking into consideration. I mean, when you look at the pricing of your PERP, it's probably not going to get called next year. I'm just wondering, like, I mean, it's 6 percentage points in terms of capital from that 13.14, which you reported at the end of first quarter. What are the thoughts with regards to that? I mean, considering the market is extremely difficult. And also, how does that, you know, mean translate into your RAC capital ratio? And the second question with regards to that capitalization, and then I'll pause because you can answer, and then I'll follow up with the other questions, is with regards to that risk-adjusted capital, which is roughly 11%. If you add the intangibles, the derivatives, and the FX, where would that number will land at?
Okay, in terms of, if I get it correctly, Lemer, in terms of risk-adjusted capitalization, some of the adjustments they make to reach that measure is that they put the intangibles, they decrease the intangibles for our equity in order to have a risk-adjusted capitalization. As Carlos mentioned, as of now, we are on levels of around 11% for the two forecast years. And also some of the things that effects that they take out of the equity come from the FX impact, such as derivative, for example. So they basically take out this kind of effect in order to measure the RAC.
Okay, gotcha. So I understood that, but the question was, if you exclude the perpetual, which is 6 percentage points of your capitalization ratio, and you land at 20-25ish, let's assume it's 25, and then so the delta, the difference in between that 25 and 11% is intangibles, FX, and derivatives. Is that correct? Is that calculation correct?
No, because, I mean, when it comes to risk-adjusted capitalization, just to remind you that we just got equity credit for $120 million. So that would be the difference.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
Right? I mean, if you look at the capitalization, I mean, and that's a figure that we will disclose, if you look at the capitalization ratio, excluding the perpetual notes, now reaches something around 23.8%, and that's a figure that we disclose. However, in order of reaching the 11, the risk-adjusted capitalization, you just get $120 million equity credit for that.
Perfect. Awesome. Thank you. I got that. So in a year where your capitalization is, because you have back in the days, in the previous quarters, you have always alluded that you target a 30% capitalization level, because that's where what's your comfort level. So how do you envision in a year where your balance sheet grows at 7%, NPLs are on the rise? I mean, yeah, you stick to your guidance of 3% NPL, which I do like. I was just wondering, like, you know, what is your guidance for the cost of risk? And how do you envision in terms of accruing organic capital on the balance sheet? Because it seems you've got this trade-off a lot. You might not be able to improve your capital ratios.
Well, I mean, if you look at the if you think in terms of cost of risk, what drove the cost of risk down in the past to, you know, pre-COVID, I'm saying, what brought the cost of risk down was the SMEs book, basically. So right now, you know, if you think in those terms, as of the end of the 2020, what drove the cost of risk up was basically, you know, what we had the reverse effect. So what drove the cost of risk up was the SME portfolio. So one of the key aspects about not relying or about unwinding the SMEs book from the 22 to the something percent definitely is going to be to improve the cost of risk as well, right? From the levels where we are standing right now to something where we something that we used to have in the past when we had an important concentration in the payroll business, which, if you recall correctly, was more in the range of the 4%. So my view on that one is that once that we normalize things, you know, probably the cost of risk is not going to stand at the 3% range, which we saw at the end of 2019, but probably it's going to be more in the, you know, 3.5% because of a different concentration in the payroll book.
Perfect. Okay. And just one follow-up questions, question with regards to NPLs. Now your opening entry level, I think it was January 2020, it was 1.7. You're carrying forward those legacy NPLs. I'm taking, you know, this Radiopolis and the latest developments out of equation. Your starting point, it was 1.7 roughly in first quarter last year. I'm just wondering, like, why would you carry forward those NPLs? Can you write off any? And what is, you know, I mean, roughly if you have that metric, the write off versus recovery ratio in the legacy book?
Yeah, I mean, yes, definitely. I guess you could write those off. I mean, definitely you could write those off, but that comes with an expense, right? So the reason for having those is, you know, that's the healthy level to have it. So probably the figure that you are saying is that you think that in the first Q, you know, the NPL ratio stood in the first Q 19, the NPL ratio stood at 1.7, and prior to the changes that we made last week, the 4Q figures isolating the effect of this single account stood at 1.8. What I'm getting is that, you know, the portfolio performed during the crisis, performed reasonably well. I guess that we could, you know, reach out those levels, and, you know, eventually we could reach out those levels, and that's what we are aiming at.
Okay, because the question here is actually around the recovery path globally is probably more positive than it was last year. You've got this U.S. kickstart on the back of it in terms of, you know, I mean, fueling the push through Mexico. So the question is, like, at what level, on based on which conditions would you write, you know, the excess NPLs? And definitely it comes at a cost. But I mean, back in the days when at the end of full year 2020, when we asked that question, because your coverage ratio, NPL coverage ratio was at 219%, you felt very comfortable. You said, like, I do want to keep my NPL coverage ratio around 200%. So now it seems like you either need, you can't write them off because NPL coverage ratio has come down. You need to build that and then write them off gradually. So it feels almost like you don't have that option at hand. Because building that NPL coverage ratio is more important.
No, I wouldn't say so, because remember that the way we provision these is based on expected losses, right? So
sure.
Based on that methodology, if you think when we used to have 220% range above the 200%, what basically, what I'm trying to explain over here is that the provisions are, if you think in those terms, is just an input. And as of the first Q of this year, the coverage ratio stands, yes, well below the standard, but the NPL stands, you know, well above the standard as well. You know, I would feel more comfortable having, you know, NPL something around the 3% range and a coverage ratio, a traditional coverage ratio of something around the 150 or something percent. But that's, you know, that's what happens as of this quarter. Yeah. In any way, I mean, what is important here is that we do not want to risk our financial health, and we are confident that we can solve this particular issue, and we are using whatever tools we have at hand to solve this situation.
All right, gotcha. Thank you so much. I do feel like, you know, for 2021, the key focus should be on steering your NPLs down, because it almost feels that's probably the crux of your entire investment thesis. Whether you look from it from a fixed income perspective or equities perspective, if you manage to keep that down and address that and potentially write it off wherever you have it possible based on your ECL, that could potentially result in positive P&L impact. Because I also recall the discussions we had at the end of fourth quarter where you said you could potentially release provisions towards the second half of 2021. But that, that angle seems to be off the table at the moment.
No, it's not. I mean, no, definitely not in anything. And this is, you know, this is part of the tools that I mentioned, you know, during the call. I mean, there are many ways to do so. I mean, it's, some of them was easy to write it off or whatever. But at least at this point, what we are aiming is reducing NPLs, you know, in a natural way. And we are confident that we could be showing some progress in the remaining of the first half of this year and put on a much better position for the second half. So basically, you know, what I'm saying is that as a part of the tools of, you know, handling this whole situation, you could see the charge-off as a safe trigger, right? But we are not there yet.
Mm-hmm. Okay, gotcha. I think, you know, I mean, personally, I don't think, like, even if you lift your NPL bar, if you move it north to a different level, it's not a big deal, but you do need to provision more and steer it, you know what I mean, try to steer it down towards the end of the year. But I got my answer. Thank you so much, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Diego Torres with MCC Itaú. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, thank you for taking my question. I do have three quick questions that I would like to touch. The first one is regarding the SME loan portfolio. Someone asked previously what is the amount within the SME group or SME loans, the top 10 largest loan, if you have that number handy. My second question goes related in terms of just to confirm the some figures that you mentioned regarding this one-off loan. That is, the provisions at this point is 55% out of the 700 million pesos. And the last one is if there's any limit in terms of the secured debt that you can issue in terms of covenants. Thank you.
Yes, I think I will address the first two questions first. And as of today, we have provisioned the 45% of the loan you're mentioning. And the first question, I think it was regarding the ticket size of this loan, which was 700 million pesos.
It's only 95.
It's only 95 million pesos.
No. You mentioned about the first question or the second question?
No, she answered the second question, where we are saying that the. What we have provisioned for this particular credit amounts roughly 400 million pesos, which is 45% of that loan. But we have trouble to understand your first question.
The first question is how much is the 10 largest loans within the SME segment?
The what? Excuse me.
10 largest. I mean, you mentioned that the 700
million
SME loan.
Okay. The 10 largest. We cannot provide detail for those. I mean, the information that we provide you is more in terms of the average ticket size that we have. And if you look at the figures that we disclosed, you know, on the average they are roughly 3.5 million pesos or something.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. That, because that's totally off with that loan that you have problems. So it's just like to size the risk of any outlier or any additional outlier. And the last question is regarding, in terms of the secured debt, if you have any limitation in terms of the amount of secured debt that you can issue, basically in terms of any covenants.
Yeah, regarding the composition of the secured debt, as of the end of the quarter, around 79% comes from unsecured debt, that it's basically the international bonds that we have. And then on the other hand, the 21%, we have a securitization program here in Mexico, which amounts roughly to 2% of the total debt that we have, and also some credit lines secured.
Yeah, but there's no restrictions in terms of the size. I mean, you can issue as much as you want, or the market can be able to absorb in terms of secured debt.
No, we have covenants that we are complying with, definitely. I mean, those exist. But in terms of securitization, as far as I understand, there's something there's some clauses on the senior notes that you have to keep some balance for 10% or something like that. But we'll get back to you on that one. In any case, I mean, what I can tell you is that we are complying. We're covenant complying at this point.
Perfect. Thank you.
Your next question comes from line of Artem Sumyav with VTB Capital. Please proceed with your question.
Hi. Thank you very much for taking my question. The first one is, could you kindly give us a bit more color on your risk management practices and principles, especially regarding concentration risk? Because I see that there's a key problem that was discussed during this call. So we would like to better understand what is your practice and how these practices allow to such huge concentration and increase of NPL of SME segment. That's my first question. Thank you.
Yeah. I mean, what I can tell you is that, without getting into the specifics about that, is that we are bolstering our risk assessment practices. A lot of people is getting involved. You know, and when I say a lot of people are, you know, this can be people, you know, from the board, you know, by setting or strengthening the credit committee at the board level, and also the credit committee, you know, internally. So basically those are the type of things that we are aiming right now in order of strengthening our processes and in order of preventing this situation to happen again. Clearly, I couldn't discuss with you the credit policies that we have, but basically what we make sure of is that we follow the right processes, and this has nothing to do with the outcome, right? I mean, whether it's a good or a bad, you know, a good or a bad business decision, but as long as we, you know, are confident that our processes are right and they are followed through, I think it's going to put us in a much better position.
Well, okay, and the second question is kind of follow-up on the first one. Could you kindly remind us, please, what is your corporate governance practice between timing of the audited annual financial statements release and earnings report? I would like to understand, do you and would you able to reduce some gap between financial statements release, I mean audited, and your earnings report, because otherwise it makes and it creates especially in this case a great mislead to investors on these numbers, and this is a huge problem for bondholders as well. So my question is, do you expect to reduce timing gap between audited financial statements and your earnings release?
Yes, definitely. I mean, basically, We will not increase, as I mentioned several times during the call, we will not increase debt for this year, and we are very, and we have, on the other hand, I mean, if I understand correctly your question, what we are very strict and robust audit of all our numbers, and basically that's it.
Well, okay, I got it. The next question, some kind of technical question. Could you kindly give us a bit more details what exactly under your investments that's on your balance sheet? It's you put this balance item to the overall liquidity. So could you kindly give a brief description what is the kind of instruments for this item, how are they liquid, right, and what is the credit risk for this investments? Thank you.
Yeah, it's basically overnight investments.
Sorry, I didn't hear. Could you kindly repeat that, please?
It's basically overnight investments.
Okay, I get it. Thank you. There's no more question from my side. Thank you very much.
Your next question comes from line of Gilberto Garcia with Barclays. Please proceed with your question.
Hello and good afternoon. Thank you for the call. My question is on foreclosed assets. In your audited numbers, in the auditor's report, you say that this is basically real estate. You also say in the subsequent event section that you gained the rights to a further 1.3 billion in two plots of land. I just want to understand if that is that related to these same foreclosed assets, because the balance quarter on quarter was flat. So I just want to understand if what is the situation there, and also if it's just two plots of land, it would seem that you have other very high ticket loans in the SME. We're talking another $65 million for these two plots of land. So I don't know if you could provide some color on those. Thank you.
Yes. Hi, Gilberto. Regarding the foreclosed assets, it's basically some lands that we executed from guarantees from our clients since the fourth quarter. So basically, in this quarter, we are having that same assets registered under this line.
And we would expect to monetize them at some point during this year.
Okay, but is this in the subsequent event, you talk about an additional 1.3 billion pesos. Is that just the technicality of now having the legal rights to the previously stated 1.3 billion in foreclosed assets from the fourth quarter?
No, I think it was, if I'm understanding you correctly, under the subsequent events, I don't know if you're referring to what we disclosed earlier this week. I mean, about the 200 million pesos in the depreciation change of methodology, or I'm not sure I am understanding, because if you look at the foreclosed assets in particular, that line has remained stable for the fourth Q and the first Q. So that's completely isolated from the rest. I'm not sure I'm understanding you, right, your question.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not sure I'm understanding correctly either. In the second to last page of the audited statements, you say that in January, you exercise guarantees for two plots of land worth a combined 1.3 billion pesos.
Right.
Yes, that's the thing that is registered under the foreclosed assets.
Okay, so it's just a technicality that you got the legal rights in January, but it is the same assets that you had previously reported in the fourth quarter, correct?
Yes, correct.
Okay, and so if it's just two plots of land, you know, it's, you know, 65 million or, you know, let's say 30 million each plot, I'm guessing this has to relate to specific loans in the SME segment. Would that be correct? Can you say?
Yeah, but one of them is divided, if I recall correctly, in eight or something like that. So yes, one of them is, yeah, it's one. So if you want to put it this way, there are like, I don't know, I think it's 9 or 10.
Okay. In a different subject, just to clarify, Renata, you mentioned that you recorded the proportional amount of the FAMSA SPV in your payroll portfolio, but is this the book value of your you know, proportional stake in the SPV, or the amount you paid?
The amount we paid.
Okay, and so I'm curious that the income, you know, continues to lag the growth in the portfolio, and given that you recorded this at the amount you paid, we would have expected that the income would rise materially, unless this portfolio was not performing all that well, but the NPL for the segment was basically flat quarter on quarter. So could you please clarify what was the, you know, impact in income?
Yes, I mean, there was an improvement in the income, and we disclosed that in the press release. I think it amounted for something around 130 million pesos or something over the quarter. I mean, the reason you don't see changes in the NPLs as for the payroll or in the consolidated is because, as I mentioned, that's not on our balance sheet, but it's on an SPV. It's on a separate SPV where we are partners along with two other players. So what we see, you know, the amount that we pay, we have grouped it under the payroll line. However, the whole book is not consolidated into our balance sheet.
Yeah, Gilberto, regarding this portfolio, I think it's worth pointing out that it's basically the same segments that we usually target on the payroll segment, basically. So they should be having the average non-performing loan that we also had on this business.
Okay, and a last question, if I may, on the other receivables, can you provide any color on when those balances might start to come down?
As I mentioned, you know, the largest portion of them, if you think in that way, the largest portion of the other receivables are entirely associated to the duration of the payroll book, right? Especially if you think in terms of the interest and the income paid in advance to the distributors and in the risk joint responsibility of the distributors, those two are entirely associated to the duration of the book. Whereas so for the rest, I mean, the big jump that you get to see comes from the other account receivable from the subsidiaries, and that comes from the consolidation of the arrendadora. You have VIP items, you have also the other things that should start to come down as long as you are collecting those facilities from the leasing business. So what I'm saying is, if you separate that amount if you split into two, everything that's related to the payroll portfolio should remain rather stable, unless you are start unwinding the portfolio down. And the other one, the ones that are associated to the ones that are associated to the other lines of business, in particular to the leasing, definitely are going to come down. It's going to are going to start to coming down as we unwind those books.
Okay, and a follow up on that, if I may, on the unwinding the in the previous quarter, you highlighted that one of the sources of liquidity would be the unwinding of the SME portfolio. It was a little surprising that the balance for SMEs actually went up a little bit quarter on quarter. Is that just a matter of the duration of the existing loans? And do you still expect to unwind the portfolio?
Yes, we do. And it has to do with the duration and something. But if you look in terms of the origination, it was materially down. No, it came down from the 3.1 at the end of the first Q last year, and right now it stands at something at 1.9 or something. So, yeah, definitely that's going to have the effect of, you know, unwinding that book, and we continue to think that way. We continue to think that we have better use of our equity in the other different lines of business, such as cars and social cars and payroll.
I mean, but if the goal is still to unwind, why did you originate close to 2 billion pesos in the quarter?
I could provide you more color into that, but some of them are renewals, or some of them are, you know, recurring customers or outside the region. But basically, it's substantially down from the what we had last year.
Yes, Gilberto, and if you compare the portfolio, for example, here in Mexico, you should see that quarter over quarter, the SMEs remain rather stable. And the one that had an increase on the quarter was the SMEs on the United States.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Natalia Corfield with JP Morgan. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Carlos and Renata. I think most of my questions were already asked and answered, but I will just like a quick some follow-ups that I have. In the answer that you gave to Diego Torres on the concentration of your portfolio, your 5 or 10 largest loans to SMEs, did you, like, what was the number that you said?
Hey, Natalia, can you elaborate further on this question?
Yes. So it's all about the your largest exposure that you said that's one-off, right? So one metric that's good to have is exactly your concentration. So how much your 5 loans represent of your total SME portfolio? Your 5 SME loans represent of your total portfolio.
We can provide a breakdown of this in terms of customers, but the information that we try to provide on the earnings release relates to, you know, not only to the concentrations, the geographical concentrations, but all the between the different lines of business. No? For example, you know, 40% is the traditional SMEs that amount for roughly 40%, and then you have all the different lines of concentration. We could provide you more color on that, but we cannot provide you a breakdown in terms of the customers.
Yeah, no, we don't need to know the customers. We don't need to know the customers, Carlos. It's a ratio that most of the largest banks, they provide for us. It's just that you take the largest loans that you have, the 5 largest, and then you see how much they represent of your total SME book. We don't need to know who the specific customers are.
Okay, Natalia, I don't have right now the figure here with me, but of course I can provide it to you later.
Fantastic. That would be useful because then we can really see that we will be able to see if your that specific loan is indeed one loan that's an outlier in terms of size. So that's why that's important. You, if you could even like provide that without this loan, would be great. But anyways, anything that you could provide, that would be fantastic. And then a question that I think no one asked yet, just on dividends. You had said in the previous call that you wanted to pay dividends. I'm wondering if this is still holding.
Yes, actually, the AGM approved that we should be paying a dividend on the first half of 2021 of 75 cents per peso, which is around 250 million pesos.
But that was approved. I mean, what is important to mention is that what, that corresponds to the 2019 payout, and the AGM, as Renata is mentioning, relates to that. However, at this point, I mean, what we are looking into is how things evolve and, you know, best use of our cash, and in order of not compromising, you know, the financial situation of the company. So
okay.
it's going to be entirely related to the financial health of the company.
Okay. And some questions just to refresh my memory. In terms of your perpetual, I understand that the interest rates doesn't go through the P&L. Am I correct on that?
Yes, you're correct. The coupons are registered on the equity, given the equity treatment of the perpetuals.
Thank you, Renata. And on the loans that have been under forbearance, my understanding is that you are not accruing interest on those.
On what loans, excuse me?
The loans that are under forbearance measures, the ones that are not paying coupons.
No, we are not accruing interest. No, we are not.
Right. And then finally, so just to recap some things that I understood in this call and something that you have been saying for a while, in terms of your SME business, at the end of the day, we should see a deceleration and I don't know, are you planning to be completely out of this? How are you thinking about the SME?
No, we should see improvements. I mean, definitely we should see improvements. As I mentioned at some point, the origination of regarding Mexico has been prudent. And we are trying to strengthen all the processes, as I mentioned, but definitely I wouldn't expect deterioration in that one.
But
what I can say at this point would be that you can expect to see a different composition of our book. Definitely, and being very emphatic about this part, is that the focus will be the best use of capital and to keep in the most profitable and best product as well.
Yeah, Carlos, I think my question was more like, I think I am understanding that you're going to gradually phase out from this business. It's going to be less relevant for you.
What we're expecting on the SMEs is to downsize this segment. So basically what we will be very prudent on the origination throughout the year, and we are expecting that at the end of the year, the concentration of the SMEs segment here in Mexico should be around the 15-16% of the consolidated portfolio.
Okay. Those are all my questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from line of Cyril Battini with Julius Baer. Please proceed with your question.
Yes, hi, good afternoon, Carlos and Renata. So I have, again, thank you for the detailed answer and for the time you're taking and your candid attitude towards responding to all of this question on this call. So I have, I guess, three very simple questions. Two of them, if you refer to the update on the COVID-19 situation. So you say that in the first quarter of 2021, there was 7.8 billion of collection. How much collection was there from the payroll portfolio out of the 7.8 billion?
It's around payroll on a quarterly basis. Payroll collections amount roughly to 2.1 billion pesos.
Okay, so from the 7.8 billion that was collected in the first quarter of 2021, about 2.1 billion came from the payroll portfolio. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
The second question, if you look at the other bar chart on the same page, is where you show the percentage of the relief program. If you could just walk, take one payroll loan, and if you could walk through the life of that payroll loan, what determines when it goes into the relief program, and what determines when it comes out of the relief program?
So the relief programs are, as of today, are entirely related to SMEs. I mean, and actually, you know, most of the practically entirely, all of the relief programs or none of the relief programs affected the payroll business. Especially, there was a time during the year, you know, it was in the second quarter, where there was some form of relief program for the pensioners, but as of today, none of the relief programs affect the payroll business. They are entirely associated to the SME business.
Okay, good. And so, and is the decision to move a loan out of the relief program, is that rule-based? If it is rule-based, what is the rule? And if it's case-by-case basis, what's the thought process
moving a loan
out of the relief program?
It's case-by-case. I mean, and normally what it happens is, and what happened last year specifically, is that we started by mapping out the segments that we believe that were more affected by the crisis and trying to define, you know, a relief program, you know, consistent with the situation of each customer. So the 2% that we are seeing as of the end of first year are mostly those, you know, businesses affected by the lockdowns at the end of last year and at the beginning of this year. For example, you know, businesses in tourism that are still affected by this and things like that. But in any case, the message that we are trying to convey here is that it's on a case-by-case basis and it doesn't follow a particular rule. It's given the knowledge that we have of the customer.
Okay, understood. And my last question has to do with the repurchase of shares on the market. Maybe if you could just explain to us what was the thought process or the rationale for that use of funds.
Yes, actually we buy back shares on a constant basis. Right now we thought it was a great timing in order to repurchase some shares. As of the end of the quarter, it was around 4 million shares that we have right now. We stopped repurchasing given that we entered the blackout period. But the rationale behind this will be to continue throughout the year supporting the share price.
Yeah, but in any case, the what is important is that the key aspect, and similar to what we said, you know, regarding the dividends and things like that, is that we will not be compromising capitalization by weakening it through the buyback program or things like that. The focus will be the financial health of the business.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Miguel Garcia with Citi. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes. Most of my questions were also pretty much answered before, but I wanted to see if you could provide a bit more color as in terms of collections and how they are trending post the quarter close, so basically quarter to date. And the second question is, What's the base case for the perps? Is this still to refi at the next call? And would you be okay still with the rating agencies if it loses the equity treatment?
Yes, of course. I will elaborate on the collection side. Actually, you could see that during the quarter we have a decrease on the consolidated collections, but it was mostly on the SME side, given that the other line of businesses were performing very well during the first quarter and almost in all the business lines such as Instagrade, the United States, and payroll, we are seeing a better performance on the collection side. So basically the decrease came from the SMEs.
And as for the third part of your cost, of your question, yeah, the base case would be to refinance it at the call. And the rationale behind that is not losing equity treatment. Not losing equity treatment. That's basically the rationale behind that. So what I can tell you, you know, as a base case, is that yes, we do have the intention. We like the instrument. I think it was very positive for the company. And if there's a market for one of those, I mean, we definitely would like to refinance it with a similar instrument.
Just a quick follow-up. So, you know, with the dividends on the table and share buybacks, with the current level of the perps, given the high discount, how do you rationalize that?
I don't know. I mean, if you look at the sharp movements that the perp had over the last 2 weeks, we would expect, and that was something that we saw during the last year as well. So, and as I was telling you, you know, if there's a market for those, yes, that would be our base case to refinance that with a similar instrument. But yeah, I we are well aware that there are a number of factors that could affect that decision, and we will think other alternatives moving away from the base case, right?
But I mean, in terms of capital allocation, don't you think maybe it makes more sense to, you know, try to address those given the magnitude of the discount?
Yes. However, if you get into that, you know, for example, buying back the PERP at this point, I understand. Though I would have to review that. I would understand that you weaken your capitalization whenever you repurchase the PERP. But definitely I understand the part of the huge discount and the profit that you would make. But as far as I understand, there's a flip side to that related to the capitalization that affects the capitalization.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Jose Saracut with Manulife. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, hello. Thank you. I think all my questions were already answered. Perhaps a comment I should make. First of all, thank you very much for making an effort here to clarify things. Now, however, I wish that the press release you guys put could have come at the same time you actually put the audited statements on Saturday night. That would have clarified certain things.
Yeah, the press release. Let me tell you something about that, because that's something that we've been, you know, that we've been thinking about it. I mean, for starters, now we are convinced that we underestimated the reaction. We underestimated the reaction when that happened. The reason for that, I mean, our rationale at the time was we would address all the situation during this call. That was the rationale behind that. We didn't disclose anything. We didn't go out because we were, you know, trying to address the whole thing during this call. So in that regard, yes, we are guilty of underestimating the whole situation. However, once that we perceived that, we believe that we reacted quickly. I mean, because there was a big misunderstanding. I mean, definitely there was a big misunderstanding, and we addressed this big misunderstanding rather quickly in the during Tuesday, and that's basically where we are standing. I mean, in any case, yeah, I think that the most important aspects of this is to be emphatic about this wasn't a restatement, and rest assured that we are, you know, and everyone rest assured that we are in a strong position, and definitely our business model is solid. That's where we are trying to convey, acknowledging the two things that I just mentioned, you know, that at the beginning we underestimated the effect, and we are guilty of that.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that. You know, from my point of view as an investor, I can live with higher NPLs. You know, things happen. The pandemic happened. No one was able to forecast that ahead of time, right? But the credibility is very, very important in the business. So I appreciate that, and you recognizing that fact. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from line of Max Vassino with Bybrook Capital. Please proceed with your question.
Hi, Carlos and Renata. Thanks very much for taking the time and for taking my questions. Just a couple to start on the audit, please. On the reclassification of the large SME loan, I mean, why did that only happen with the audit? Why was that not already taken into account for the original unaudited Q4 results? Or what changed in the meantime?
Because it wasn't 90-day past due. That was the main reason. This was a loan that effectively was past due, but it was not past 90 days past due. So if you think about the NPL definition that we have is 90 days, 280 days. That's basically it. So basically, I mean, what I'm now moving into the second part of the second part of the explanation is that then why it was recorded as an NPL, because the original structure was a bullet. It was, you know, a 4 month, if I recall correctly, it was a 4 month facility with a bullet, and the auditors, you know, following what we perceive as the most strict standard, they decided that it should be treated as an NPL, and that was basically the case, you know. It wasn't 90 days past due, so it was, you know, the auditor, at least for these particular credits, was very stringent on how these needed to be accounted.
Right. Okay. And I mean, besides this, obviously, large loan, which had, as you say, you've discussed it before and had obviously quite a lot of media attention as well. I mean, do you have other loans in the book that are in a similar state of, you know, past due, but not 90 days past due? And you know, how do you look at those? Do you have a certain bucket for them? You know, what roughly is the proportion of those?
Yeah, if you look at the difference between the 3.3 and the 3.9, those are it. I mean, I'm speaking about the fourth Q figures and the first Q figures. If you think about the difference between the 3.3 NPL ratio for the fourth Q and the 3.9, those are it.
Right, but I mean, on an ongoing basis, I mean, at any point in time, you'll have past due loans as well, in addition to the NPLs, right? So, you know, in addition to the 3.9%, what at the moment would be your past due, but not more than 90 days past due? What proportion of the loan book?
I don't know, because there are when we speak about NPLs, we are only speaking about those 90 days. So if you ask me, those are more like operational figures. I mean, our teams over here in the different lines of business, they are, you know, monitoring those loans. You know, since day one past due, they start monitoring those loans. But as for NPLs or for accounting purposes, I mean, we just follow them from 90 onwards. It would be, I mean, getting into the operational details.
Right. It's just, you know, from a monitoring and sort of risk management perspective, you know, of course, the past due loans are the ones that are more like, you know, most likely to become NPLs, right? So I imagine it's something you should monitor on an ongoing basis to assess, you know, the potential incoming delinquencies. But okay.
Yes, we definitely do. And yes, we definitely do. And this I can answer you as a collector, because I believe that I'm more collector than anything else. And yes, we start monitoring from day one, and there are different strategies depending on the different business segments. Right now, given that the focus of the company is on the asset performance, we are very strict, you know, we are very stringent since day one in all the different lines of business. And the message here is that collection is our top priority at this point.
Right. Okay. And just another question on the audit, please, because I think you gave the two explanations, right, which are, you know, this one bad SME loan, which was moved to non-performing, and also the change in the depreciation schedule from the auditor. But I noticed that there were other large movements in other lines. I mean, interest expense, for example, went up 7.5% on the numbers I have from the Q4 to then the audited full year. Again, looking at the full year 2020 basis, in the investment securities balance was, you know, taken down by 7%. I mean, there were movements elsewhere on the P&L and the balance sheet that I can't understand from just those two items. So were there other adjustments? And if so, you know, what were those? You know, what explains these other movements?
Yes, of course. Hi, Matt. The difference in the interest income and the interest expense regarding what we disclosed previously on the fourth quarter is that for an investor presentation, what we do in the earnings release is that the exchange impact, if it's a gain or a loss, we register it under the interest income in order to be consistent throughout the period. But on the audited financial statements, what we need to do is that if we have a foreign gain, we are going to register it under the interest income, and if we have a foreign loss, we register it under the interest expense. So it's basically.
Right. But so then you're saying it was really an FX move, and it shows up in the interest income and expense lines rather than below those as it would in the quarterlies, or is this all happening within the net interest income lines?
No, we, as I mentioned, for the earnings release for investors, what we do is that we reclassify any gain or loss, exchange gain or loss, under the interest income line. On the audited financial statements, if it's a loss, we're going to register it under the interest expense. And if it's a gain, you will have it under the interest income. On 2020, given that we experienced a foreign exchange loss, you could see that the interest expense was higher.
Right. Okay. And that FX gain or loss, I mean, is that on the asset side or the funding side in terms of how it affects those two lines?
It's regarding the balance sheet exposed positions.
Well, I'm just so the FX gain or loss. I mean, presumably this is mainly on the funding side rather than on the asset side, right? But I'm just trying to understand why, you know, an FX gain on funding would show up in interest income, and equally, yeah.
Yeah, it's on both sides, actually. If you want further explanation about this, we can gladly chat later, but it comes from both sides.
Right, thank you. And my final question is just on the on the payroll segment, and apologies if this is a stupid question, but you report 55.5% average interest rate. And it's roughly 31, 32 billion peso total portfolio. So why is the total income in a quarter only, you know, 1.37 billion pesos, which would suggest a much lower interest rate?
Yeah, the most important thing is that you need to remember that we have an agreement with our distributors where we share the 50% of the income and the risk. So that's why you could see that if we charge an interest rate to the client of 50%, we normally have a yield on levels of around 20 to 25%.
But the, so you share the 50% of the income with the distributor, but who, I mean, the funds are advanced in full by yourselves, right? So do you, I mean, you take kind of all of the funding costs, but only half of the interest income?
Yes, that's right. We have the funding side, but on the other hand, the distributors absorb all the operation expenses, like paying the commissions to the sales representatives, etc.
Right. But even then, if I do the simple numbers, I mean, I get to a sort of yield of close to 17%, which is, you know, is even less than half of the 55.5%. I mean, are there other adjustments in there? Is sort of more than 50% share of income that's been paid away, or what explains the difference?
Yes, the difference that we are having regarding the yields, for example, 1 year ago, were like several factors that affected payroll overall. That's why you could see a decline on the yield. However, we are seeing right now a stronger performance on the payroll side, which is pushing up the yields of the business right now. And we are expecting that given the concentration or the focus we are having in enhancing these business lines, the yield should be pushed forward throughout the year.
Okay, but just to understand, just specifically on the first quarter. So if you report the 55.5% interest rate, but if I divide that by two, you know, on a single quarter basis, I mean, it would be a higher number than the interest income you report in that segment, you know, quite materially. To do it another way, if I take the 1.37 billion of income, you know, and annualize that, I get to a 17% yield, not a 27% yield. So, you know, what explains that difference?
Look, given the nature of your questions, we definitely can address this explanation offline. We definitely address this explanation offline. So let us get back to you and
I will follow up with you, Alex, in order to get these all questions and all the explanations. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have reached the end of the question and answer session. Thank you all for being in today's conference call, and we apologize for any technical difficulties. You may now disconnect.
Thank you all.